One of my professors once impressed something on me that I have never forgotten. I hope I never do. He said, God gave us his word in words. The words of Scripture matter. The words, the little ones and the big ones, how they go together, the grammar, the syntax, everything matters because God gave us his word in words. He has revealed himself to us in his word, and so when we read the Bible, we ought to read the words. And you know what I realized when he said that? I realized that very often when I read the Bible, I wasn't paying as much attention to the words as what I thought they might mean. The individual words. I wasn't paying that much attention to the individual words. I was immediately jumping past the words to, oh, what does this mean? Or what does this mean to me? The words matter. God chose those words. When we say that the Bible is verbally inspired, what we are saying in a very fancy way is God himself chose the very words that he would use to reveal himself to us in Holy Scripture. We're going to talk about one word here on Issues, Etc. during this hour. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our guest, Dr. David Adams, we're going to talk about the Hebrew word chesed, which, well, when I was in the seminary, they taught me it meant mercy, loving kindness. They taught me it meant love. And then suddenly the definition started to multiply and I realized, well, maybe this word means a lot more or can mean a lot more than just one thing. We'll find out what it means. Usually the Hebrew word for faithfulness. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. If you'd like to join our conversation, our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Adams, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Tom. It's always good to be here, as always. I was walking downstairs before the program and thinking, you know, this really hasn't changed so much since 1977. It's been 25 years off and on. I've been here in this studio doing things on KFUO, which, you know, made me think there probably aren't just a whole lot of radio stations that keep people around for that long, and certainly people who aren't getting paid. So must say something about the value of what happens here at KFUO.
We keep around the people who don't require that they get paid. That's why they stay around as long as they do. And I'm sure that the studio is more run down than it was in 1977.
But no, actually it's not, because, you know, it was renovated in the early 80s when they put in this stuff and the
yeah, I remember that.
Right here, the control room.
I remember that, but I was about to say, you couldn't tell. Anyway, yeah. Our subject is going to be but one word. Now, before we start talking about chesed itself, this Hebrew word for faithfulness that is so common in the Old Testament, there is a major danger we need to observe and steer clear of. What is it?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I picked this word just so we could talk about it. It's one of my favorite words in the Old Testament. It is used quite often, as you mentioned. It's used, the noun is used 256 times. And the adjective form of the word is used another 34 times, and the verbal form of the word is only used twice. So it's, you know, used altogether between 250 and 300 times. So it's
and
a common
word. That's a lot, considering that the Hebrew vocabulary of the Old Testament is very small.
It's very big. The Hebrew vocabulary of the Old Testament is very big.
I'm sorry, yes.
And that's right. Almost half of those usages, by the way, about half of those usages are in the book of Psalms. So a very big word, particularly in the book of Psalms. And as we'll see as we go along, a big word when it comes to talking about God. But the word is not only important, but it's also very illustrative of the point that you just made. Namely, that it's a word that if you don't understand it carefully can get you into a lot of trouble when you're trying to study it in the Bible. This is true for pastors, beginning seminary students, and lay members who might pick up things like concordances and tools like that to do studies. You were talking about God, you know, giving words and seeing them in the context of grammar and syntax just a moment ago. I usually like to tell my students that 80% of the meaning in a text is really in the grammar and syntax, and 20% is in the vocabulary. Now, the reason for that is the grammar and syntax establish the context. And without the context, you don't know which one of the possible meanings of a word actually needs to be applied here. You and I were talking before during the news about how some people will just look at a Bible dictionary and they'll see that this word can mean five things, and they think they're free just to pick any one of those five they want. And anybody who's done any in-depth study of the Bible knows that that's not true, that words don't have meaning in the abstract. They have meanings in the context. And to know which of the possible meanings of a word is the right meaning here in this verse, you have to look very closely at the context. And that means not only the etymology or the historical background of the how the term developed, but also especially the grammar and syntax of that particular verse.
So in other words, if I looked up the word chesed, let's say I've got a Thompson Chain reference or one of those kind of Bibles that has Hebrew words listed in the back, and I can look at the number and I find out, oh, there's the Hebrew word. And I look it up in a dictionary or a lexicon, I might find four or five meanings. You're saying I can't just say, well, that meaning seems good to me, pick it out and say that's what it means in this verse, in this context, without paying attention to the context.
That's exactly right. This word would have more than five. Let me just give you an example. By the way, the word chesed we're using, for those of our listeners, in English you might spell it C-H-E-S-E-D. C-H-E-S-E-D would be kind of an English equivalent. And we'll probably be referring to that Hebrew word quite a few times here as we talk about it. So it's probably good to have a sense of what we're pronouncing in mind. But here are some of the ways this word is translated. You mentioned mercy and faithfulness. We kind of picked faithfulness as the English word for today. We'll talk more about that as we go along. Loving kindness is another one. Kindness is another one. Covenant love is used in translating this word sometimes. Mercy, grace, but also words like faithfulness and integrity. And even words like Holy One or Saint, and even actually the word stork, you know, the bird, is the Hebrew word for stork, is the feminine form of this, chasida. So it's kind of in there, too. They only use that way one time in the Old Testament.
Okay, so this has multiple meanings. Before we go on, you use several terms. Grammar.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a very brief definition of what you mean when you say the grammar of a text or of a verse. And you also use the word that's probably less familiar to our listeners, that being syntax. What do you mean when you say the syntax of a verse?
Well, grammar, sort of simply speaking, is the rules of a language. So in English, you know, we might say English verbs have a present tense like go and a future tense like will go and a past tense like has gone or went or had gone. Those kind of rules for organizing the way a language works, that's what we call grammar in shorthand, including in Hebrew the forms of the words. So, for example, in English, the word dog is a singular word. If you want to make it plural, you put an S on the end and say dogs, plural. So those rules about the forms of words and the rules by which the language operates, that's what we mean by grammar. Syntax is not the rules that govern how the language, the words of the language are put together, but the rules that govern how words are put together into sentences and phrases and clauses. So, for example, in English, we would say normal English usage is we have a noun followed by a verb. The man went to the store. In English, we don't say went the man to the store or went to the store the man. Well, Yoda does in the old Star Trek movies. But normal English usage is we put the noun first and then the verb and then the indirect object. Or the direct object, I hit the dog, you know, not the dog hit I. Although we probably figure out what the person was trying to say, it's not good English, as we would say. And that's what we mean by syntax, the way words are put together to form phrases and clauses and sentences.
So to bring this together, when we're looking at an individual word and asking ourselves the basic question, what does this word mean? We can't ask that question or answer that question unless we take into account its place in the grammar of the verse and its place in the syntax of the verse, and then begin to explore its possible meanings there.
That's right, and we'll see this precisely as we look at the various ways that the Hebrew word kesed is used and how it's how that affects the way it's translated in English.
One more question on that. What is the danger of simply opening up my dictionary where I found this word kesed, finding seven possible meanings, and just choosing the one that I like the best? What's the danger there?
Well, the danger is you'll almost always pick the wrong one. You know, you'll end up with the wrong meaning, and in a sense, you read your own preferences, your own ideas into the text instead of determining what the text is saying to you. So instead of hearing the Word of God speaking to me, I'm imposing my ideas upon the Word of God.
So just because a word can mean something in the Bible doesn't mean that when you find it in the Bible, it does mean that?
That's right. And we do this all the time in English without thinking about it. For example, if I say, that's cool, you don't have a clue what I mean unless you have a context. You know, you're asking me how I like my food and I say, that's cool, then you probably understand that I'm talking about temperature. My steak isn't as hot as I would like it to be. It's cool. If, on the other hand, we're listening to a piece of music and I'm kind of bobbing my head and acting like I'm enjoying it, and I say, it's cool, you understand that I don't mean it, you know, it's low in temperature, but rather I mean it's something that I like.
So the meaning of words is determined not only by the inherent meaning, possible meanings that the words carry, but by the context in which they're used.
That's right. In formal studies, we say that words have semantic fields. The term semantic field means the whole range of meanings. Picture like a circle drawn on a blackboard. And in there you got little dots inside the circle. And each dot would represent a potential meaning of the word. That's the semantic field, the range of meanings. What the grammar and syntax, the rules of languages and sentences, do is help us figure, and the context does, is help us figure out where we are in that semantic field. You can't just pick any word you want out of there, out of that semantic field. And that's what makes translating the Bible both exciting and interesting, and also very challenging. And this word kesed is a major challenge for translators. I think it's of the words that are common in the Bible, this is the most difficult word to translate.
Now, before we go back to those meanings you listed, give us the history of this word and how useful is searching out the history of words, their lineage, if you will, their parentage. How useful is that in discovering what a word like kesed means?
Well, the mistake that many people make is they assume that etymology, which is the fancy word for the history of the meanings of a word, you know, what a word's parents were and where it came from. Many people make the mistake of assuming that etymology is determinative. That is to say that if you know what a word originally meant, then you know what it means today. And to go back to the example I used a moment ago, cool meant to be cold in temperature a long time before it meant to be, you know, something I like. And there are those who would very blithely say that if you know the etymology or the history of a word, then you know what meaning there is. I remember reading a biblical interpretation book a number of years ago now where the person was arguing that if you go back and you look at the first time a word is used in the Bible, then you know what it really means. And you can apply the meaning of the way it's used the first time it's used in the Bible to all the other places that it's used in the Bible. And that's just an absurdity.
So we could use the example, perhaps, of one that's often on the lips of, in the ears of people today, the word gay, where we obviously...
You were talking about it last hour.
We obviously recognize that what gay originally meant, at least in English usage, happy, buoyant, emotionally buoyant, joyous, really, not only is it no longer used that way, the word no longer means that unless you explicitly say, I'm feeling happy and gay, and I don't mean homosexual or something like that.
That's correct. And so the historical meaning of the word no longer or very rarely applies to the meaning today.
What is the historical meaning of the word chesed, this word we're calling faithfulness?
It appears to be kind. That is to say, to do something nice. And that's part of the argument in this case. The word is not used a lot outside the Bible in other languages. And that's part of the difficulty in determining what it means in the Bible. But it does occur a few times, and it appears most often to mean something like to be kind. But at the same time, it often also has overtones of sort of doing the right thing. That kind of language. And we'll see both of those themes, both of those two tracks, emerging in the biblical usage as well.
We're talking with Dr. David Adams, and we're talking about the Hebrew word chesed. It means faithfulness and other things, as we'll discover. He's Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Feel free to join us. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. You had mentioned that it originally means to be kind or to do the right thing. Does, when we get to the meanings of this word chesed in the Bible, does a lot depend on whether or not we're talking about who is the subject, whether it is God who exhibits this characteristic of faithfulness, or whether or not it is man who exhibits this characteristic?
That's part of the debate. But in fact, when we look at all the usages, it appears that both of those elements, both the be kind element and the do the right thing element, apply both to God and to man. And we'll look at some examples as we go along here of how that works. The older translations of the Bible, I'm thinking of all the way back to the ancient Greek, for example, you tend to use words that mean something like mercy, the word that you heard before. So the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament, uses the Greek word eleos, or mercy. The Latin translation uses misericordia, again, mercy in Latin. Interestingly, some of the other translations, the Jewish Targums and the Syriac, use words related to the word good, or goodness, something like that.
I'm trying to think of the place where our listeners would most recognize this word in a familiar Bible passage. Is there you mentioned it often appears in the Psalms. Is there a psalm where our listeners would be most familiar with hearing this word, chesed?
Psalms and other verses. We'll go through some here in a few minutes. But let me just pick a couple out to illustrate the range of ways this word is translated. For example, here's a verse that most people will know. From Psalm 16, verse 10, this is a verse that's used in most funeral liturgies and funeral services. Speaking of God, it says, "You will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption." Now there the word chesed is used for a holy one, a saint. Or another one, Psalm 116, 15. "Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints," or holy ones. Now, this is a translation that most of us have heard, but it doesn't bring out the idea of mercy here very much. This is the idea of being faithful to to doing the right thing, as it were. Let me give you an example of some with a different meaning here. Let me go straight to one from Genesis chapter 24, verse 27. Here, this is the context where the servant of Abraham is being sent to find a wife for Isaac. He says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, for he has not forsaken his steadfast love toward my master." Now, this is the same word that's translated saint in Psalm 16. Obviously, the word saint wouldn't fit in the context of Psalm 24. I'm sorry, Genesis 24. Let's see. Here's a very famous one, probably one of the most important verses in the Old Testament. We'll come back to this one, but it's one that most people will have heard and will know. The Lord is passing in front of Moses as Moses is, you know, on the side of Mount Sinai there. And as he passed in front of Moses in Psalm 34, verse 6, God says, he defines the name Yahweh, or the Lord. He says, this is what the name Yahweh means. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in chesed, abounding in love and faithfulness. Now, here's a word where the word faithfulness is used right after chesed, so a different characteristic there.
Now, I remember when I was a kid learning that phrase, the Lord, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love.
Steadfast love, yeah.
Is that steadfast love, all those two words, a way of translating just that single word, chesed?
Yeah, and what that translation is trying to do is to kind of bring both of these ideas of faithfulness and mercy together in one phrase, trying to get both of these threads in there.
All right.
And that's what that that phrase is trying to do.
Now, those are a few of the examples of the range of meanings here. Where do you begin when you come across a word like this in the Old Testament? You're studying and it's in its original. Where do you begin? What's the first? I have to have a word that I put in to kind of hold the place until I figure out what it means.
Yeah.
So I say, okay, blah, blah, blah. Mercy, is that the word I put in there to hold its place until I get a better or a more nuanced meaning for it?
Well, that's what makes this particular word so difficult. And here, I guess I have the advantage of, I just use the word chesed as my placeholder. And so, you know, come back and try to fill in the blank there. But where I begin, but yeah, you almost have to find some, we call those placeholder words, by the way, in translation. We call those glosses, G-L-O-S-S, a gloss. A gloss is a sort of a quick word to stick in place of something else. And you kind of have to maybe have those as a way of starting off. But what I do when starting to look at a word, and this is what we'll do as we go forward here, is I start to classify or organize the way that a word is used in its different usages, and then kind of figure out what usage is applying here. So, for example, when I sat down to look at chesed for this program, what I did was began to look at all the usages, and I saw that they kind of fall into four categories. One, when the word is used to talk about God's character, that is, some aspect of what God is. Two, when the word is used to describe God's actions, or something that God does, which is different from the aspect of God's character. Thirdly, the word is also used to describe human characteristics, you know, what I am. And fourthly, what humans do. And so those are, so when I start to study a word, I begin to categorize those usages. And that's where we'll look at as
and
we go.
That's what we'll do when we come back. Dr. David Adams is our guest. We're looking at the Hebrew word for faithfulness and mercy and so many other things. The word is chesed. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Give us a call, 1-800-730-2727.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Congresswoman Marilyn Musgrave has introduced a bill that gives homeschool students equal treatment under the law. Right now, many laws exist that either exclude homeschoolers altogether or don't put them on a par with their public school peers. David Brody reports.
The bill has a lot of provisions. Chief among them is making sure homeschooled students get a fair shot at financial aid and scholarship opportunities. In some states, these kids can't apply for some scholarships.
I think there needs to be more acknowledgement and respect for the movement.
Congresswoman Musgrave also told me about another change she's looking for.
This amends the child labor laws to allow these home-educated students to work during the day when they would normally be in school if they went to a public school.
All these changes amount to one thing, leveling the playing field.
The federal government needs to catch up with the homeschool movement.
Chris Klicka and his group, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, wrote the bill. With the homeschool movement almost 25 years old, he says it's time to get Uncle Sam moving with the times.
But now the homeschoolers are growing up. The homeschool movement's growing up, and so as a result, the laws need to be adjusted to reflect this new status or this new type of student that's out there.
The bill also protects homeschoolers' academic records. If you're in public school, the federal government protects your records. As it stands now, homeschoolers don't have the same safeguards. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The bill has a chance. It has the support of Education and Workforce Chairman John Boehner, and that should ensure it life through the legislative process. Supporters say even if the whole bill doesn't pass, they plan to attach certain parts of it into different education bills to move their agenda forward. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Lori Susan Kahn about Sleepaway, the girls of summer and the camps they love. John Perry writes about Charles Colson in the years preceding Watergate. In Charles Colson, a story of power, corruption, and redemption. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
What motivated Dietrich Bonhoeffer's classic writings, The Cost of Discipleship and Life Together? Find out with a book, Till the Night Be Past, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Till the Night Be Past is a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. Till the Night Be Past, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, 1-800-325-3040.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking with Dr. David Adams about just one word from the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for faithfulness, chesed. He is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Now, so far in the conversation, we've spent some time issuing a, kind of a major caveat, a warning, that just because a word can mean something, just because it can mean one or two or three things, doesn't mean that you can pick and choose the thing you want it to mean when you're reading the Bible. Just because it can mean it doesn't mean that it does mean that thing in its context. You have to read a word in its context, its grammar, the way the words go together, and then determine what it is among all those possible meanings the word means there. And it might mean something different elsewhere depending on the context. This is not rocket science. This is nothing to get worried about. This is the way human language works. This is the way we talk. Dr. Adams gave the example of cool. In one context, it means low in temperature. In another one, it means something you like, something you appreciate, something you think is hip and happening. But those are two different meanings, and it all depends upon the context. The other thing we talked about was the danger of saying, well, the word originally meant thus, and therefore it must mean that here. Just because a word originally meant one thing doesn't mean that it always means that for all time and eternity, and that's obvious to us because words change their meanings. Now, before the break, Dr. Adams, you mentioned four ways that you categorize this word whenever you come across it in the Old Testament, falling into one of four different categories. Review those again for us, and then let's work from there with examples, beginning with the first.
Okay. I said the word chesed is sometimes used to describe God's character. Then other times it's used, especially in the plural in Hebrew, to talk about the things that God does, which is different from God's own character. Then thirdly, it's sometimes used of humans to talk about human character. By the way, you can see this. Most people will know this word, at least. They will have heard of Hasidic Jews. It's really the same word pronounced with a soft H instead of a hard H. That is to say, Hasidic or Hasidic Jews are, as we would probably translate it, faithful. That is, they're the most faithful to the deepest Jewish tradition. So that's a word used to describe human character. And then also it's a word used to describe human acts as well. So I think it'd be good to just to kind of walk through these and see how some examples of how the word is used and what it means, and then how we decide what it means in those various contexts.
Let's begin with God's character, and I think that's it would be wise for us to come back around to God's character too at the end. But let's begin with the God's character. Give us some examples where this word for faithfulness, chesed, is used to describe God's innate character, something that is within him.
Okay. I want to pick up the one that I quoted earlier, because it, in some ways it's the most important one, from Exodus chapter 34, verse 6, where Yahweh is appearing to Moses on the mountain. And this one is important because this is the this is one of those passages in the book of Exodus in the Bible that we call self-revelatory, that is, where God tells us something about himself. In fact, this passage is so important. This is the most quoted part of the Old Testament in the rest of the Old Testament. This verse is quoted seven more times in the Old Testament. So it's the place in the Old Testament where that's quoted the most by the rest of the Old Testament. And so God passes in front of Moses and he says, Yahweh, or the Lord, is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and now the word chesed, which is often translated loving, merciful, kind, something like that, and faithful. That is to say, he is full of chesed, and he is faithful. So here we get a list of aspects of God's character, of descriptions of his nature. He's compassionate. He's gracious. He doesn't get angry quickly. Then when he gets angry, he is quick to forgive. And that's what chesed means in this context. And then, finally, the word faithfulness on the end there implies that when God forgives something, he really does forgive it and continues to act in accordance with his decision to forgive. So here we get a very important description of God's character.
Now, you said this was a self-revelatory passage here, and when you're saying God is explaining to Moses who he is by way of defining his name, Yahweh. Yahweh, semicolon, here's the definition, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love was the way I learned it.
Mm-hmm.
Can we say, therefore, that this word is an element in describing essentially who God describes himself to be? How God says, this is who I am the one who can tell you who I am, I will describe myself to you, and he uses this word as a major element of that?
That's right, and here, getting back to context, the context in the book of Exodus is really important. You see, this is right after the golden calf episode, and if you think about how the book of Exodus unfolds, they leave Egypt, they go to Mount Sinai, God gives them his Torah, his teaching, the Ten Commandments, from Exodus 19 to 24, that block of material that tells them how they should live as the people of God. And they swear in chapter 4, rather 24, that this is what they're going to do. They're going to keep God's law perfectly. Well, that leaves an open question. The open question is, what's going to happen if they fail to keep all these laws perfectly? And of course, as the story unfolds, not only do they fail to keep it perfectly, but they fail spectacularly, right? In chapter 32, the golden calf, right away at the beginning, the first step out of the box before Moses has even come down from the mountain, and they have already spectacularly blown the relationship with God. And so the question is, how's God going to respond? The answer, in short, is God's going to respond in accordance with his character. And in the process of responding, God reveals who he is and what he's like. This is the Old Testament equivalent of that verse in the New Testament that we all know very well, God is love.
to tease this apart a bit, God could have said, the Lord, omnipresent, omnipotent, yes, omniscient. He could have started, as we tend to do it in kind of our logical categories, he could have started listing characteristics, abstract characteristics of himself. It strikes me here that when he's going to tell Moses who he is, he doesn't even mention any of those things.
No, and the reason for that is our way of thinking about those characteristics of God is heavily influenced by Greek philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so the characteristics that we pick up, the ones that you mentioned, omnipresent, all-powerful, present everywhere, without beginning, without end, and so forth, those are very heavily, the early church emphasized those great deal because of trying to communicate to the Greek culture. And so, as a result, we've tended to emphasize those more than the terms that are actually used in the Bible, in the Old Testament in particular, and in the New Testament, for that matter.
Is it safe to say that God reveals himself here to Moses as first and foremost, not excluding other things, but first and foremost, merciful?
Yes, and that's the point of the rest of the story here in the next verse. And people will know this next verse very well, too. If we go into 34:7, God says, abounding in love and faithfulness. And then it goes on, maintaining love to thousands, forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes children and their children for the sin of their fathers to the third and fourth generation. Well, we hear this a lot, and people always kind of cringe when they hear that. God punishes children for the sins of their fathers to the third and fourth generation. But they miss the whole point here in this verse. The whole point is the contrast between the thousands of generations to which God is merciful and the little bitty three and four to which, he exercises his judgment. So the point of the verse is trying to emphasize how much more God's grace outweighs his desire to punish.
That brings us to the second category, and that is not God's character in particular now, but the second category for this word being God's actions. Can you give us an example from the Old Testament where this word chesed is used to describe the actions of God as opposed to something of his essential character?
Yes, I can. And we probably, if we're going to kind of analyze this term, we would, I said we would divide it into these four big groups. Well, this one we're going to subdivide into two groups because we find that when we look at God's actions that are described as chesed or faithful / merciful in the Old Testament, that they actually fall into two groups. One group are those places where God acts appropriately, that is to say, God acts the way he would expect to act. And the second group is where God goes far beyond what would be expected of him. So, for example, the first one, God acting appropriately. We might, as long as we're in the book of Exodus, let's go back to the Ten Commandments, where God says, you shall not bow down to them, that is the false gods. This is Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Well, see there, God is showing, God is treating people in accordance with how they behaved. They have loved him and kept his commandments, and he is responding in kind. So that's one way that God acts.
Acting appropriately.
Acting appropriately. That is to say, he is responding in kind to their action. But much more important and much more common in the Old Testament are examples where God acts in a way that goes beyond what would be expected of him. Just to stick in the Pentateuch, which is my area, so I kind of always run home there when I'm looking for Old Testament examples first. Here's a case where Lot, in Genesis 19, is speaking. He said, "Behold," this is Genesis 19, verse 19, "Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness, great chesed, in saving my life." Well, Lot didn't do anything to earn God's favor. You know, here he has, God goes beyond what would be expected of Lot. They have, Lot and God don't have a covenant between them, you know, by which God is supposed to reward him. But rather, God goes beyond what would be expected of him. The same is true, let me pick out another example here. I had a good one here later on. Well, to go back to the one, in another example from Genesis 24 with Abraham's servant, God has not, in Genesis 24, verse 27, "Praise be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness for my master." You see, God had not, God did not owe Abraham anything here. He had promised him a son, but he didn't. Abraham hadn't done anything to deserve a son. In fact, Abraham, by trying to have a child on his own with Hagar, in a sense, kind of pushed aside God's promise and tried to do it his way.
Is this second, way that God goes above and beyond what would even be considered appropriate in showing kindness, is this akin to the New Testament concept, and I guess it now is an Old Testament concept through this word, of grace, undeserved favor?
Right. And that's exactly the point, you see, that I was going to make with regard to translating these terms. The first category, when God acts appropriately, God acts in a way we would expect him to act, we might translate kesed there with a term like faithfulness. God is faithful to his covenant. We see that phrase a lot using the word kesed. God is faithful to his covenant. In other words, God made a promise. He's going to keep his promise. He's going to do what he said he would do. God is chesed. He is faithful. On the other hand, there are many instances in the Old Testament where God does something where he hasn't made a promise to do it. God is initiating the action without any sense of the recipient of the action deserving it. And so there's a case where we would translate this as mercy, or as I prefer to translate often, grace, the very word that you picked up. God shows grace to people who haven't deserved it in the Old Testament.
I don't want to throw you a curveball, but do you know, you mentioned before the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. Do you know if the Septuagint ever translates this word, the Hebrew word kesed, with the Greek word for grace, Karin or Karis?
I don't know if it ever does. It regularly translates it with the term mercy. I wouldn't want to say that it never does it without actually checking first. I'd have to get my computer out and fire it up and hunt for a few minutes. But the normal way is with the word eleos or mercy.
To put a bow on the God side of translating this word, Psalm 136. Has a refrain in all of its 26 verses. It continues a constant refrain. I learned it. For his mercy endureth forever. For his mercy endureth forever. And interposed between those refrains is the history of God with his people, from creation all the way up till the time the psalm is written. Does this, in a way, serve as kind of the summary of God saying, this is how I deal with my people in kesed, in mercy, steadfast love, faithfulness?
And here's a good case of why this word is so hard to translate. In some cases, you know, God has made promises, and God keeps those promises, so we'd be inclined to translate kesed as faithful. In other places, God has simply acted on his own initiative without owing anybody anything, without having a commitment, as we would say today. And so those would be places we would translate with mercy or grace. There are some of each in Psalm 136. And that's why some people will translate this with a term like covenant love or something like that, trying to, again, bring both of these threads together. And the point they're trying to demonstrate, I think, both in the psalm and with those kind of translations, is ultimately God's faithfulness to us grows out of his character. That is to say, God is faithful because he is loving. See, these aren't two threads that are opposed to one another, but ultimately they're related. That God's continuance, his forbearance for us when we sin, his promise to forgive us and his carrying through that promise happens because of his loving, merciful, gracious character.
I think that Christians sometimes misunderstand God profoundly by thinking, okay, God is first and foremost holy and just. He happens at times to also kind of break character and be merciful. But it sounds as though the Old Testament picture is that for God to be merciful is not for him to break character at all.
No. In fact, if you go back to Exodus 34, God is, in a sense, breaking character when he's judging. You know, God's, the thousand is what is God's normal way of operating. The three and four, when he has to punish people, you see, his justice requires him to do that. And that's why we sometimes refer to, the law, God's grace as his proper work, and in theology, and his judgment as his, as the alien work of God. Because God is, in a sense, not breaking character, but he's, the lesser part of his character is his judgment. His grace far outweighs this. And that's why it always drives me off the cliff when I hear people talk about the God of the Old Testament being this God of judgment and wrath as opposed to the God of love in the New Testament. These are obviously people who've never read the Old Testament.
I mean, I guess everyone has a place, a characteristic that they pick and choose from God's characteristic. They say this is primary and this drives the rest of him. But it sounds as though God's mercy always drives, even when he is just, it is his mercy driving his justice. And he does it for the sake of his mercy.
God always wants to forgive and be gracious. Sometimes, in a sense, we won't let him. We're so determined, we're so hardened in our sin, so determined to reject God's way that God's justice cannot allow him to overlook that. We will not receive his grace and be moved by his spirit to repentance. We are hardened in our hearts.
With the few minutes left to us, let's explore then the way this word is applied to human character and human action, obviously not to be compared with God's character or actions.
Well, really the same dichotomy arises. You see, the word chesed is sometimes used of people doing something kind or characterized as kind people. But it's also used to characterize people who do the right thing, who behave in the correct and expected way. Let me give you an example of somebody from the Old Testament who's doing what's right, chesed as doing what's right. Here's one, again, just picking my favorite ones always from the book of Genesis. This is Jacob speaking to his son Joseph in Genesis 47:29. We read, "When the time drew near that Israel, that is Jacob, must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, 'If I found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to,'" this is the ESV, "'deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt.'" In other words, if I've been good to you, then do the right thing by me. Don't bury me in Egypt. That's what the verse is saying. So there, you see, "deal kindly" is probably not a very good translation there. A better translation would be, "If I found favor in your sight, then repay me in kind." Mm-hmm. Don't bury me in Egypt. In other words, I've been good to you. Be good to me in kind. So there's an example of chesed being used to act appropriately, to do the right thing, to behave with integrity. Now, an example of going beyond what's expected. Here, let's go to another passage, or at least a part of Scripture that people will know very well, and that's the book of Ruth. You remember in Ruth, in the story, Naomi has two sons, and they're living in Moab, and the two sons get married, the two sons die. And then the Naomi says to the two daughters-in-law, "My sons are dead. I'm not going to have any more sons to be your husband. So go back to your people and, find new husbands." And we read there, Naomi blesses the two daughters and says, "Go, return. May the Lord deal kindly with you." Ruth, of course, decides to stay. Okay. And then later on in chapter 3, verse 10, Boaz, who, you know, Ruth's kinsman who ends up marrying her and being the grandfather of David, the ancestor of David, Boaz calls what Ruth did chesed. In other words, he calls it an act of kindness. Now, you see, Ruth didn't have any, there was no expectation that Ruth would need to go with her mother-in-law. She was not legally bound to do so, nor was she morally bound to do so. She did so because of her love for her mother-in-law, not even for her love for her dead husband. But her mother-in-law had said, go with my blessing, but Ruth stayed with her.
Now, we talked extensively about this with only a minute here before. You said God's actions, when it comes to God, his mercy, it come from his character. With a minute and a half before we have to go, make that point again.
Okay. And I want to go one step beyond that and say that both this term as it's used of the faithful people of God and their actions also flow from God's character, ultimately. Because what shapes our lives is the grace and mercy of God in Jesus Christ. And the fact that God had chesed moved him to promise to Eve that he would undo the work of the fall, and then promised him, then moved him to be faithful to that promise, to keep that promise through all the succeeding generations and all the things God had to do in the Old Testament to work out things so that the Messiah could come. And so God showed chesed, he showed mercy, grace, and he showed faithfulness in making that promise to Eve after the fall and in keeping that promise throughout the history of Israel until the Messiah came. By the grace which God has shown us, we grow into the image of Christ, and then we act with chesed, with faithfulness, with integrity as well, and both in keeping God's law and in going beyond what is expected of us too. Not only do we do unto others as we would have them do unto you, but we sometimes even turn the other cheek and forgive 70 times 7 and go beyond what would be expected of us in human terms.
Dr. Adams, thank you very much for being our guest. Folks, read Psalm 136 tonight. Sit down and read it. And the word that will ring again in your ears all the way through those verses is this word chesed, God's mercy. It is who he is in Christ for us. It is his mercy, his love, his faithfulness, his steadfast love. It endures forever in Christ. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.